My name is Mike Seelig, and this is KXRW's The Good Ship Earth. Before we begin, I'd like to invite you to go to kxrw.fm to visit our merch page and sign up for a monthly membership. Becoming a monthly member makes you a part of Vancouver's only radio station and helps us cover our monthly operating expenses. It also gives you the chance to pick up some pretty cool, ultra-exclusive, limited edition KXRW t-shirts, tote bags, and mugs. Thank you. If you've ever traveled to the Midwest or many parts of our country, you'll see how flat the topography is in comparison to the beautiful Northwest. We've got Mount Rainier, St. Helens, and Mount Hood. In all, there are 3,753 named mountains in the Cascade Range. Those mountains are a source of beauty and year-round recreation for all of us. Those mountains are also a monstrous clue as to how our world will change. The Cascade Range is just part of what is known as the Ring of Fire. That ring is shaped like an upside-down horseshoe. One leg starts at the southern tip of South America. It goes up the west coast of the United States and Canada, then crosses over and drops through Japan, the Philippines, and ends up on the eastern side of the Australian continent. 75% of the world's volcanoes are located along this ring. 90% of our planet's earthquakes occur within the Ring of Fire. I figured that learning about the potential threat of earthquakes and how I can prepare for them is just part of living in the Northwest. One of the things I learned is that there's a large earthquake fault about 50 miles off our coastline. It's called the Cascadia Subduction Zone. It runs from Cape Mendocino in Northern California to the southern tip of Vancouver Island in Canada. Stephen Eberline with the American Red Cross Cascades Region spoke about the Cascadia Subduction Zone at a TEDx conference in Portland on April 10th of 2018.
I want to tell you a new story of the Pacific Northwest. The story of the Pacific Northwest begins 3,000 miles away. To be exact, 3,000 miles beneath your feet. Because up from that spot in the core, there's a massive column of magma, which is rising to two massive plates out at the sea. And those two plates are spreading in opposite directions, but their journey is the same. Right now, the Juan de Fuca plate is sliding right underneath your feet in the exact same way that the Pacific plate is sliding beneath Japan. Now, the story doesn't end there, because that plate, as it dives, the friction and the depth causes it to melt. It becomes a pool of magma, it rises to the surface, and creates landscape. This process created Mount Fuji. This process created Mount Hood. This process created Mount Rainier. And unsurprisingly, this process created Mount St. Helens. This process is called subduction. And subduction is about a lot more than beautiful landscape and occasional volcanic eruptions. It's also about risk. See, right now you're standing on North America, and North America actually goes all the way out to the ocean, where it is locked with the Juan de Fuca plate. Now, the Juan de Fuca plate is pushing and pushing so much that the edge of North America is bowing, like a ruler being pushed at both ends. And eventually, it collapses, and it starts a domino effect, where all the weak spots along that fault line begin to give way. And in the worst-case scenario, we have a 9-point earthquake that shatters the infrastructure of the Pacific Northwest.
Please keep in mind that a 9-point earthquake is worst-case scenario, but there are very strong reasons that worst case is more likely than not. That's because Cascadia hasn't had an earthquake in a very long time. There are some areas in the world where earthquakes are frequent, and that actually can be a good thing because those smaller quakes release the energy of the advancing plates and doesn't let it build up. The fact that Cascadia doesn't let loose very often allows the advancing subduction zone plates to build up energy, that bowing of the ruler that Stephen Eberlein mentioned. That continued bowing is storing up enough energy to potentially cause the most destructive earthquake in the history of this planet. There's another threat that Cascadia poses, and there's a very recent example of that threat. It was in 2011 at the opposite side of the Ring of Fire in Fukushima, Japan. Here's a CBS Sunday Morning report titled, Only a Matter of Time.
In March 2011, the world watched in awe and horror as a colossal tsunami ravaged eastern Japan. The result of a 9.0 magnitude earthquake. Entire cities were washed away. Millions stranded without power or water. 15,000 died. It was an otherworldly event, thousands of miles away. Thank goodness, many of us thought. It couldn't happen here. But it could happen here. In fact, scientists say it's a question of when, not if, a devastating earthquake, followed by a huge tsunami, strikes the continental United States, right here in the Pacific Northwest.
This would be like five or six Katrinas all at once, up and down from California to Canada would be the closest thing I can think of.
It may sound like a Hollywood disaster movie.
I see it!
But it's not. This is the future for the region's 7 million people, says Chris Goldfinger, a paleoseismologist at Oregon State University. In fact, his research shows much of the region is overdue for a major quake. The last one was back in 1700, long before there were large cities right in harm's way.
If it happens anytime soon, it would just devastate the area.
Goldfinger estimates there's a 1 in 3 chance the quake will strike sometime in the next 50 years.
Would you say that we're prepared for something like this?
We're not completely unprepared, but we're pretty darn close. On a scale of 1 to 10, we're probably a little shy of 1 at this point.
This is Ground Zero, the 700-mile-long area off the Pacific coast called the Cascadia Subduction Zone, where the North American tectonic plate meets another plate known as the Juan de Fuca.
The dark image we're seeing here is literally sliding under the lighter image.
That's right. So they're converging but still stuck. Hmm. And so what happens is the weaker plate, which is North America, buckles. And eventually something's going to give. So the coastline that's been jacked up over 500-ish years or so is going to drop about a meter in about a minute or so.
And that's just the earthquake. Next, as we saw in Japan, comes a tsunami, with waves as high as 50 feet roaring on shore, reaching miles inland. It's a threat the government says it's taking seriously. But
is FEMA ready for the big one?
I would never say we are ready.
Ken Murphy is the administrator for FEMA Region 10.
These represent the roads that can be affected by the earthquake or out here on the coastline can be affected by the tsunami.
The agency has spent years preparing the federal response. FEMA's best case scenario, 10,000 dead. And that's assuming no beach tourists, which would lead to their worst case scenario, simply too terrifying to contemplate.
Depending on when it happens, we're talking numbers that this nation, I'm not sure, is really prepared to deal with.
Potentially the greatest natural disaster this country has ever experienced?
I would say it has the potential for that. This is an event you send everything to and scale back down if you don't need it.
The quake could displace 1 million people from Northern California to Southern Canada. Large parts of Seattle, Portland, and Vancouver will crumble. In coastal towns, roads and bridges will likely be impassable, stranding whole communities. The region's economy could collapse. Rebuilding might take years, even decades.
The tidal wave that devastated Fukushima reached 100 feet high in some areas. It caused an estimated $360 billion in damages, and it claimed 16,000 lives. Here's a clip from a report from Maya May with the PBS Terra series called Weathered. She interviewed engineer Allison Perch about her visit to the devastation area in Japan. And then we'll hear from Chris Goldfinger again.
It toppled most of their tsunami walls, inundated huge amounts of the Japan coastline. And we were there 6 to 8 weeks after the tsunami, going and standing there and smelling the fish smell. And you can imagine where the water went because you can see the water lines on the trees on the hills around it. You can see the pieces of people's lives strewn around. So as an Oregonian, that's really hard, knowing that that's what our coastline's going to look like.
And while the Tohoku quake in Japan was the costliest natural disaster in the world's history, here on the West Coast, the United States, we're nowhere near as prepared as Japan was for this kind of disaster.
If that had been Cascadia and I'd been at work, my building would have collapsed. There's no question about it. I might have gotten out, I might not, but it would be gone. Everybody thought Cascadia was aseismic, meaning no earthquakes, because historically that's what it was. It was dead silent. And then the first evidence was discovered in the early to mid-80s and realized that we just happened to be sitting in a quiet spot.
Over the last 10,000 years, geologic records show that there have been 41 subduction quakes here, which averages out to about one every 250 years. The last one came in the year 1700. That's 321 years ago.
The geologic record for major Cascadia earthquakes indicate that we're long overdue for another one. Allison Perch took the PBS Terra team out on the Willamette River to look at downtown Portland and the tank farm in the Northwest Industrial Area to talk about what will happen during the next big quake.
If you were looking at a bird's eye view of Portland or Seattle, very soon after shaking started, bridges and other longer infrastructure are going to be warping and falling off their foundations. You would see unreinforced masonry buildings start to collapse. This is where 95% of Oregon and Southwest Washington's fuel is brought in and stored. These tanks will deform, they'll spill. Any type of spark or metal hitting each other could also start a fire. The Cascadia subduction zone earthquake is going to be one of the worst disasters America has ever seen.
I mean, I came home from Japan feeling optimistic about it, but at the same time, I look around at the Pacific Northwest, and I can see just visually that, yeah, we are 1,000 years behind, and this is not going to be easy to catch up.
Now that the reality of the Cascadia earthquake is really clear, I'm going to share how we can feel less helpless and prepare for the next big quake, right after a short break. Programming like this is brought to you by the generous support of our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at adco1.com. That's ADCO, the number 1.com. KXRW Radio would like to thank our newest sponsor, Fusion CBD. Fusion CBD offers a wide variety of whole plant, full spectrum, hemp-derived wellness products. From premium hemp flower to edibles, topicals, and pet products, Fusion CBD has what's right for your mind, body, and budget. Fusion CBD is located at 9102 Northeast Highway 99 in Vancouver, or find them at fusioncbd.com. There's nothing worse than feeling helpless in the face of a catastrophic threat. Action is being taken by local agencies to respond to a natural disaster, but it's not enough. Experts say that after a large 9.0 earthquake, that the three-day emergency kit we've all heard about won't be enough. Think more in terms of going at least 2 weeks before help can get to you. In this clip, Maya May interviews a guy who has taken steps to be prepared, not only to help himself, but also people in his neighborhood.
Mark Ginsburg is a Portland NET, or Neighborhood Emergency Team leader, and has been preparing for the big one for over a decade. Despite living and breathing disaster preparedness, Mark surprisingly doesn't seem too overwhelmed by the inevitable earthquake.
It's not the thing that keeps me up at night, because I know that I can't control it. I understand where I live, and I understand that that's a possible risk. But I also know that if I do some preparedness work and if I do trainings, you know, this year I redid my first aid and AED trainings. Those are the parts that I can do and that I can control. There's your house and the physical things, there's the knowledge, and there's a plan. But I think having the things that you as a family or a household need to just be independent for a little while is really crucial.
Here are Mark's top five most important things to keep in your home or garage when preparing for the big one.
Shelf-stable food, water, 1 gallon per person per day. Good fire extinguishers, more the merrier. Two-bucket toilet. Toilet seat, clips on the bucket. Toilet paper, sawdust for your poop. 4-in-1 gas shutoff tool. Water shut off on the bottom, gas shut off on top. If you turn off your gas, you leave it off and let the pros turn it back on.
Shutting off your gas can be crucial to stopping fires. If you smell gas in your home after an earthquake, Mark suggests grabbing your 4-in-1 tool and simply turning the valve to the off position. It's easy to feel discouraged or overwhelmed when thinking about preparing for a disaster as large as the big one. But I think we could all take a page out of Mark's book.
The time to figure out what to do is not after the earthquake, the flood, the fire, but to know in advance if those things happen, what should we do?
You don't have to join a local emergency team, although it's great if you do, but just taking small steps today to start your preparation, like picking up a gallon of water or a few extra cans of soup for your pantry, can go a long way.
People will want to help and will step up to help to the best of their abilities. That's what everything shows will happen and what has happened in the past, and we can expect that's what's gonna happen should we need it in Portland.
Whether you live in earthquake country or tornado alley, you need to be prepared to help yourself. A good start is to put together supplies to shelter in place and make up a go bag. Maya May tells us how.
First, we're going to talk about what you need at home to comfortably shelter in place. Unlike a pandemic, most disasters heavily affect our infrastructure. So being self-sufficient without electricity, water, or transportation is the first priority. You can think of it like planning for a long camping trip. What will you need to survive and be as comfortable as possible while doing so? Your most important supply by far is plenty of water, even if it's raining. You'll need 1 gallon per person per day. Experts recommend having enough for 2 weeks, so for a family of four, that will come to a total of 56 gallons of water. Next, you want to have 2 weeks worth of food. Now, that's probably more than you think, but the easiest way to do it is with a pre-packed disaster food kit with dehydrated meals. But that can get expensive. So my strategy is this. Whenever I have an extra can of soup or mac and cheese or something else that I know won't go bad, I add it to my apocalypse storage bin. After a while, I have a lot of food and it never felt like a big expense. And I don't drink coffee, but if you do, plan to add some caffeine. A disaster is not the time to quit cold turkey. Once you have food and water in a safe place at home, you'll probably want to pack these crucial items. A hand crank radio. Now, cell towers and internet may be out of service, so an alternative way to receive communication is crucial. Mine has a solar panel, a phone charger, and even a flashlight. A headlamp or a flashlight, and extra batteries. And while we're talking about batteries, you're also likely to need an extra mobile battery for your phone. As long as cell towers are working, your phone will be a crucial tool to get help and tell family you're safe. A toolkit for basic repairs. You may not have immediate access to medical treatment depending on the severity of your disaster, so pack a first aid kit. In my first aid kit, I have a wound care section with things like antibiotic ointment, Band-Aids, and antiseptic towelettes. In a disaster, even a small cut can lead to a life-threatening infection. In fact, the World Health Organization estimates that in 2017, sepsis accounted for a staggering 20% of all global deaths. Taking a first aid class is a great plan since you're probably not going to be able to get the help that you're used to during a disaster. Just a little bit of basic knowledge can save your life. Also, make sure to include extra prescription medications since pharmacies may be closed for a while. Pack photocopies of important documents and seal them in a plastic bag so they don't get wet. At the very least, remember to include your identification, health insurance cards, and info for predetermined out-of-state contacts so that you can get in touch even if your phone dies. I also highly recommend stocking up on personal toiletries. Listen, you don't need 10 weeks worth of toilet paper, but do make sure you have things like soap, toothpaste, and whatever items you generally use. I like to keep some extra chapstick handy. But unfortunately, you won't always be able to shelter in place, either due to evacuation needs or because your home didn't make it or is unsafe to be in. In situations like this, you'll want to rely on your go bag for supplies. You can think of it like a portable version of your pantry, but with a few modifications. As with your pantry, water comes first. Keep several bottles of water in your bag. Also, purification tablets come in handy if clean water isn't available. Next on the list, again, is food. You want to prioritize non-perishable, high-calorie snacks. I've got some energy bars and some dried fruit. You're also very likely to need access to money, so keep some extra cash and a credit card in your bag. Since a lot of things you'll need in your go bag are also things you need in your pantry, you can just store those items that we mentioned before, like the hand crank radio, those important documents, extra batteries, and a mobile phone battery in your backpack so it's easy to pick up on your way out. Also, a smaller but similar first aid kit. Another thing that I love to keep in my bag is a miniature, portable version of my toolkit, a multi-tool. It has all sorts of useful things on it, from a screwdriver to a knife, even scissors. Also, don't forget to bring an extra change of clothes appropriate for the weather where you live. Remember a couple pairs of clean socks and a jacket, even if it's warm. And last but not least, leave a little extra room in your bag for your valued personal items. When we talk to people who evacuate, nearly everyone said they grabbed a few important items like wedding rings, a photo album, or whatever is most important to them. If 2020 has taught us anything, it's that you never know what the future holds. Prepping can seem daunting, but doing something is a whole lot better than doing nothing. And taking small steps today, like buying a gallon of water for your pantry or picking up a box of granola bars for your go bag the next time you're at the store, may make a big difference when the next disaster strikes. And not only are you likely to fare much better when something goes wrong, but you'll be better equipped to help your friends, family, and neighbors.
We've learned why and how to prepare for disaster, but a person's mindset is just as important. Elizabeth Hardister is a public health advisor with the CDC. In April of 2018, she gave a talk called Be More Than a Bystander.
When Tilly Smith was just 10 years old, she saved the lives of as many as 100 people in one day. How? She and her family were vacationing on a beach on the coast of Thailand when the water started to bubble up. The ocean started to disappear into the distance. 2 weeks earlier in geography class, she'd learned a lesson on tsunamis. So that day, she recognized these signs, warned her parents, who worked with hotel staff to evacuate the beach. Her beach was the only one without reported casualties from a tsunami that impacted 14 countries. So not bad for a 10-year-old girl. For her book, The Unthinkable, journalist Amanda Ripley interviewed hundreds of disaster survivors in order to describe how we process these events. She details a three-stage arc of what we go through. The first stage, denial. This isn't happening to me. The second stage, deliberation. Okay, what am I going to do about it? And the final stage, which she calls the decisive moment. People always talk about the danger of panicking in an emergency, but what she describes is the tendency for some people to underreact, not overreact. They freeze. What separates the ones that freeze from the ones that act? It's not fearlessness. It's not complacency. I've learned it's knowledge, planning, and practice. Preparedness starts first and foremost with the recognition that these events can happen and that you must take personal responsibility for your own safety. In emergency management, we seek to leverage the strengths of individuals throughout a community. The government standard for emergency preparedness is self-sufficiency without phone communications, running water, or power for 72 hours after a disaster. And by preparing for emergencies, you're reducing the strain placed on emergency responders so that they can dedicate their time and resources to the most vulnerable members of your community. Also, by preparing, you can take care of the people around you. You can respond. But you don't need to know how to perform complex medical procedures in order to help out in emergencies. Remember Tilly Smith? All she needed was a little geography knowledge and the conviction to take action. By taking care of yourself first and by preparing for disasters, you empower yourself to help the people around you. Like we saw during Hurricane Harvey, the Good Samaritans who were ready for the storm were able to open up their businesses to provide shelter to those in need. In our own community during Hurricane Irma, students helped pair those needing shelter with people offering up space in their homes. These are just a few examples of what ordinary people can achieve in disasters. I know this sounds simple, because it is, but because we deny that these events can happen to us, we fail to prepare for them altogether. So first, knowledge. Be informed, look around you in your home, in your workplace. What are the most likely hazards you might encounter? An easy way of staying informed is signing up for your local emergency alert system. Also, you can follow local public safety officials and meteorologists on social media. Going a step further, will you share information with the people around you so that they can take action? Second step, planning. Plan for these most likely scenarios. An easy way of starting your planning is building a basic emergency kit. Food, water, flashlight, batteries. It's worth the investment. And finally, practice. Practice your plans and the actions that you might need to take. Who knows first aid? CPR. Overcome your fear of those terribly creepy CPR dummies and get trained. And bonus credit on this, if you've got a fire to get involved in local disaster response, join an organization. Throughout America, we've got community emergency response teams which provide training to volunteers on how to aid their communities during disasters. So why wait? Far too often, we put off preparing for disasters until it's too late. Amanda Ripley writes, "Regular people only figure into the equation as victims, which is a shame, because regular people are the most important people at a disaster scene every time." Knowledge, planning, and practice. Through these simple steps, you can prepare for disasters in order to ensure the future resilience of yourself, your neighbors, and your community. Don't just stand by, stand up and take action.
You can find longer versions of talks from Chris Goldfinger with OSU, engineer Allison Perch, and the video series Weathered with Maya May on YouTube. The American Red Cross has a lot of useful information online about disaster preparedness and planning. This is Mike Selig with KXRW's Good Ship Earth. You can visit my show page at kxrw.fm/goodshipearth. My hope for you is that you've learned something useful from this show and that you can take that knowledge to help ensure the safety of your family and friends. I'd like to share one last thought from Stephen Eberline.
Never have so many people understood so much about an earthquake as ours. But knowledge is not wisdom until it changes you.